This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, Michael, you have the right to remain silent. Part of popular culture, part of law, and very much something that seeped into a whole lot of our popular culture.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything that you say, as I hold you.
You didn't lead off with country music? You were firing me up right now. It's like my birthday.
I searched for the words. And
there
that's
you go.
What,
I like
that's
it.
That's what came up. This business emanates from a case called Miranda, and it has an origin in Phoenix. This is 50th anniversary, in fact, and we have two guests today. One, a retired police captain by the name of Carol Cooley, who was a police detective who arrested Ernesto Miranda, which set in motion the entire process. And a little later on, Robert McWhirter, an attorney and legal scholar, who will put some of this into perspective. Captain Carol, the floor is yours. You were a police detective working Central Phoenix. And tell us how you got involved in all of this.
Yes, I will. Well, the story starts of the Phoenix Police Department's involvement in this case on March 3rd, 1963. A young lady, she's 18 years old, was abducted at knife point off the street in Northeast Phoenix. She was tied up, taken out into a remote area where she was... Her clothes were removed by the suspect, and she was forcibly raped. After the rape, he then took her money, and so the case would be a kidnapping, rape, and robbery investigations. My role in this, as a young detective, 27 years old at the time, been a detective for only about a year and only in the crimes against persons detail for about a month. And so I was new to this particular kind of an investigation. The investigation starts with the routine thing of re-interviewing the victim, any witnesses, family members, anybody that can, in fact, lead you into something else in this case. The police were called, and a patrol officer arrived. His name was Page. And Officer Page recognized right away that this was a major case investigation. At that time, the detectives, we had a night detective, two of them actually, that would take these major cases. They came, and first off, they interviewed her and Officer Page's story, and they had her taken to Good Samaritan Hospital emergency room. There, she was given an examination for rape by two physicians, and after they got the story, they returned to the police department and handwrite their reports in that day. So the report would have landed on the Crimes Against Persons sergeant's desk the next morning, and that would have been the 4th of March. And when I came to work that morning, he handed me the investigation. Today they would call him a case officer. Back then we called it follow-up officer. And so my role would be to interview and get more information, which I did, more information on the interior of the car, which later on proved to be useful. And interviewed a fellow co-worker who had walked to the bus with her. And from there, by the end of the week, I had exhausted all of the possible people to talk to and leads that we had at the time. The suspect was described as a young, probably mid-20, Hispanic or even Italian suspect because of his lack of any Hispanic speech problems
or accents.
And so once We had this information at the end of the week. I went home Monday morning the 11th. I came back to work, and when I got there, I was told that there was a report from an officer, Anderson, a patrol officer. He had been called to the home once again during the night, which was a little after midnight when this young lady got off work, and on that particular night, on the 10th, there was a relative that had been walking down to the bus stop where she gets off the bus, about four blocks from the home. And while he was there, he saw a car riding or driving slowly through the neighborhood. There was a lone occupant, but no real identification on the driver because it was dark. But he did note the license plate, DFL 312. And so he reports that to Officer Anderson. Officer Anderson checks the car out that night, the license number, that is, of the car. And it was registered to an Oldsmobile, and the Officer Anderson or another officer went by that address to check if that car had been driven. It had not been driven that night, so we had a misinformation on the license number. After getting that DR report, DR's departmental report, I went out and contacted the relative and talked to him about the car. It was considered or told to be light green in color. He was not so sure about the license number. He did think the DFL was what he remembered because he had nothing to write it down. It was all by memory. And so we had a wrong license number. And he then described the car, what he thought to be an old Packard, and he thought it was a 1953, and he recognized that because he had a friend once upon a time that had such a car. From there, I took him to the local Studebaker and Packard dealership, as Otis Bacon, back on Indian School Road at that time, and we found a 1953 Packard, looked at it. The interior of the car was such that it matched what the victim had told us about the interior. From there, I took him back home, and then I went to the department. And the department is 17 South 2nd Avenue, and that's where the police department was. It's where the museum is today on that very same floor in that building, a historic building, by the way.
And Captain Carroll, if we can stop you right there, we'll get going back to the department here in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back more on the 50th anniversary of Miranda with the actual arresting officer, the detective, right here on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Captain Carroll, the arresting officer of Ernesto Miranda, a name that's probably familiar to many. Continue the story.
Yes, call me Carroll. That's my first name. And I'm no longer a captain. That's been a long time ago. But anyway.
I thought an honorific like that you kept forever.
Thank you. I went back to the department and called Motor Vehicle Division and had him check all DFLs. That's the only part he was sure of. And there was no computer in that day, so it was a hand count. Could be as many as 1,000 cards to go through. So they had called me back, they said, later that day, and they did, and it was a DFL 317 registered to a 1953 Packard on a street in LeBaron Street in Mesa, Arizona. Late in the day, the sergeant thought that it would wait till the next day and take another officer with me. We did that because we were going to be talking to a person of interest. The car is seen a week later. So there's no real connection to this crime at this point. So my partner's name was Bill Young, and we went over to Mesa, and the home was vacant. We talked to some neighbors and found out that a young man and his wife and three children named Ernie Miranda lived there, and they had moved out on the Sunday a couple days prior to this. We from there went over to the Mesa Police Department, and we asked in their record bureau if they had anything on a young Hispanic male by name of Ernie Miranda. And they had a record on Ernie. And it seemed that he had been involved in a similar situation, a molesting, where he had saw a woman as he was peeping through the window. That was his favorite hobby. And he saw her nude.
Sounds like he's becoming a suspect around this time.
Well, he's becoming a person of interest, yeah, put it that way.
Strong interest, sounds like.
So anyway, that particular thing, that incident in Mesa caused him to go to the Fort Grant School for Juvenile Criminals. We checked the truck he was moving in was United Produce. And after we checked Mesa, we went by there to find out. They said he worked for them on the night shift, which was downtown Phoenix, right along Jackson Street. And since, once again, it was a little late in the day, so we had this particular name now and no other real information. So the next morning is the 13th of March. Bill and I go over to the post office and we inquire about a change of address. There was one. It was to 2525 West Mariposa. So we proceeded to that address. There was a car parked in the driveway, a DFL 317, a gray Packard, not green. And as we walked by, we looked in, and the interior matched very much what she had told us the interior would look like. But, of course, that's the interior would have been on all Packards in that day. We knocked on the door, and a woman come to the door. She's carrying a baby, and a couple of other small children were with her. And we asked if there was an Ernie Miranda here, and she said, yes, he's asleep. So we asked if she could awaken him. We, of course, identified ourselves as police officers. He came to the door a few moments later. Obviously, he had been asleep. He asked what it was about, and we said, we would like to talk to you about a police matter. And he said, well, come in. We came in the house, and while we were standing in the living room with his family and him, he asked again. We looked around, and we saw the supposed wife and the kids, and we said, we'd rather not talk to you about this in front of your family. Would you go with us to the police department? We'll check it out, and if you're not involved, we'll bring you home. He said, okay. So he then went into the bedroom to get further dressed because he wasn't completely dressed having been awakened during the night or early morning. Now, that's important from a policeman's point of view because if he had been under arrest, we'd have never let him go into the other room out of our sight because he could come out with a gun and shoot us or kill us, obviously. So he didn't know why we were there. Maybe he suspected, but we had not arrested him. That's interesting because the Supreme Court said we arrested him at his home, but that wasn't the case. We drove him to the department. He sat in the back seat alone. He was not handcuffed. And my partner sat on the passenger side, and I drove. That's another point for a police officer to know that we would not allow a suspect to do it and sit in the back seat alone without being handcuffed. When we got to the department, we went into what we called interrogation room 2, and we spoke to him for about 30 minutes. Once again, we didn't have any solid evidence. We had no probable cause. We began to suspect, perhaps, we had the right guy, but nothing actually, and he denied everything. So we eventually said, would you stand in a lineup? If you're not identified, we will bring you home or take you home. And we said there would be a couple of people at least that wanted to view this lineup. So we left him in the room. I went and tried to make calls to three different victims we knew about now, which I didn't know about when I walked in the door with him. But the sergeant had given me the information on two more and said, question him about these. My partner arranged to get some inmates from the jail that would match the description of the suspect, Hispanic males. When we had the lineup, the first person to view the lineup was the case that I was working, the kidnap rape. She looked through the glass that you could see in but not out, and she immediately said, it looks like the number one man. My response, are you sure? That was a police procedure, get a positive. And her response...
Looks like being ambiguous.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So her response was, well, it looks like him, but maybe if I heard him speak, I would be able to identify him through his voice as well. I said, okay, well, we're going to put you over here in another room, and we'll be back with you, and we'll do that. But in the meantime, I have another person. So I brought in a lady by the name of Barbara, and she had been accosted by a guy with a knife, forced his way into her car, drove to an alley not too far from there. This was all in the downtown area, close to where my victim happened to work. And at that point, she looked into the room, and she immediately said, it looks like the number one guy. And once again, are you sure? And she says, well, it looks like him, but I'm not absolutely positive. We're going to now put you over here in another room, and we'll be back with you once again. Bill and I go into the room, and he asked me, Ernie asked me, how did I do? And I said, you didn't do so good, Ernie. And he said, well, I guess I better tell you about it then. I says, yes, I think you should.
All right, now we're getting that. We get right into the juicy part of the Miranda case, right? Right, but the Miranda arrest, 50 years later. We get the real story right here on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back discussing Miranda with the arresting officer, then Detective Carol Cooley. You
left with Ernie's in the hot seat. Ernie right. Miranda's in the hot
He's
seat.
Been identified
yeah.
in a lineup.
Yes. The second victim positively identified him when we went on a nose-to-nose or one-on-one.
For a separate crime.
Yes, the separate crime. We had another crime that we confronted him with. We couldn't get a hold of the victim. And we did that by the fact that the victim had reported the guy with a tattoo mm-hmm. with a tattoo on his hand, EM. And the MO in her case was the same as the one for Barbara.
So how do we get to the confession now?
After he confessed verbally, I simply asked him, would you... put that in writing. And he said he would. He was very cooperative. We were very easy with this mm-hmm. whole interrogation process because we started off with not enough probable cause. Mm-hmm. And we were very, very careful. So he does.
I'm struck by having looked at that handwritten confession, this guy had immaculate handwriting.
Yes, he did. And just at the very beginning of this report, it's a departmental report, says victim suspect statement form, and it starts off I, and then he fills in his name, do swear that this is a voluntary confession, no threats, coercions, or promises of immunity, understanding my rights, and anything I say can be used against me. That's on the form itself. Mm-hmm. So he knows that. He writes out the confession. Very beautifully handwritten confession. Spelling was excellent. The description of the sex act was not slang. It was the anatomy of the mm-hmm. two people was, it, you know, precise. And after this, he was arrested.
Okay.
Charged him with two crimes. We went to court in June, I think it was, that year. Back in those days, you got to court a little quicker than today. We convicted him on the first crime, Barbara's case, because it was the oldest. Mm-hmm. We had a verbal confession, and we had a positive ID. And he was convicted 20 to 25 years for armed robbery. Mm-hmm.
Now, I assume at this point, he's convicted. You go back to your day job, right?
Just about. The second trial is a week later. And it's the case that I was working on as my follow-up case. Once again, we have the confession, and it takes about just a few days in both of these cases mm-hmm. To get a conviction. After the conviction, he's given 25 to 30.
Did he recant the confession in the trial?
No.
No.
And so after that, it was appealed to the Arizona Supreme Court.
Well, let me bring in Bob McWhirter at this point,
sure.
Because I assume at this point you're this is sort of out of sight, out of mind. You're probably just
well.
Vaguely
when we
aware
finish up the conviction, and I've gone
your
to court.
Your job is done.
Yeah, my job was done.
Okay. Short summary of what Bob McWhirter, attorney. What happens then?
Well, then Miranda, he goes to trial, gets convicted. The case goes all the way up through the Arizona Supreme Court. Now, the Arizona Supreme Court, with an opinion by Justice McFarland, who, as I recall, was one of the founders of
Channel 3.
Family-owned
family.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Justice McFarland, who was a pretty famous Arizona justice, governor, all kinds of things.
I met him there at Channel 3.
Oh, well, there you go. Uh-huh. Well, he wrote the opinion saying, basically, look, this confession is perfectly fine, and the fact that Miranda never asked for a lawyer was important. That was a key reason why the confession was upheld there,
okay.
Which is what sets the case up for the United States Supreme Court. So the case goes up to the United States Supreme Court. And the question really, in a lot of ways,
what were they arguing real quick from the Arizona Supreme Court? So what were they arguing that took it to the Supreme Court? Just that he didn't have legal representation? What were they arguing?
It is much more a case about the right to a lawyer. Legal representation than it really even is about the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Now that the court goes back and forth on whether it's a Fifth Amendment right or a Sixth Amendment right all the time. In many ways, what the Phoenix police did and what Detective Cooley did really wasn't the point. Nobody really said they did anything
wrong. And that was standard police practice at the time, right?
Well, sure.
No, nobody anywhere alleged that they did something that was out of line for police practice at the time.
No, in fact, if you look at the issues that Miranda really dealt with, it wasn't standard police practice. It was really good police practice, mm-hmm. what the Phoenix police did at that mm-hmm. point. And to some degree, that wasn't the issue. The issue is, when do you have the right to be told that you can have a lawyer? And it kind of goes along with this thought of, hey, rich people always know they have a right to a lawyer. So when do we tell everybody they have a right to a lawyer? Now, you have to realize there's some background here. It was only in 1963. Okay, 3 years before Miranda, that the Supreme Court came down with Gideon versus Wainwright, which said
right
to an attorney. Before that, if you got arrested, it was pretty tenuous whether you were going to have legal help or not. So this is all part of that. You know, the next case, of course, comes in 1964, which is Escobedo versus Illinois, which says that Escobedo was kind of an interesting case because Escobedo was accused of killing his brother-in-law, kind of a dysfunctional family, right? Mm. Well, the police had him in interrogation for 14 and a half hours, in stark contrast to the mm-hmm. couple hours that the uh-huh. detective had Ernesto here. 14 and a half hours, and Escobedo said, hey, I want my lawyer. And his lawyer's out in the lobby saying, hey, I want to see my client. And the police separated them. So the Supreme Court said, no, that's not
good. The facts of that one seem a lot more egregious.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So then this is getting to the next level of where you get a right to a lawyer and when you can have that right. And that's really the issue of the case. The interesting thing about Miranda, and you already brought that out, that, okay, he had great handwriting, he used good grammar. This man was not forced or coerced into writing a confession. This was not a voluntariness case. This was a case about when the right to a lawyer attaches and when you tell people it attaches. Mm-hmm. Miranda's nice. By the way, I've made this point. Miranda is the only Supreme Court case that I can think of that's become a verb.
Okay,
to Mirandize.
Right. Yes.
I can think of no other Supreme Court. I mean, you know, if you're going to – you don't say, hey, boy, you really Dred Scotted me on that. No. It's to Mirandize, and that's why it's become so important in the culture about what this right is that you have. And I think that's what the Supreme Court was focusing on. This could have very easily been called Westover versus United States or California versus Stewart, which were companion cases. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, it's called Mirandize because it just rings a lot better to say mm-hmm. to Mirandize. Mm-hmm. But again, that emphasizes that really what the Phoenix police here did wasn't the issue. It's what rights do we have as part of members in this American experiment and under our Constitution to a lawyer. And that's key in the case. So
let's bring this back to – so the Supreme Court throws out the conviction. Then you're back in action. What happens then?
Well, after that, of course, the Supreme Court overturned on a 5-4 decision. Split. They were very. It was very controversial.
After there's new ground.
Yeah, at the time. So they remanded it back to the lower court, Maricopa County Superior Court. So we went to trial. Now he never got out of prison. until he served his time, because the first case, interesting enough, was not appealed. Same time, same place, same confession, more or less, same room.
All within the same. He stays incarcerated for the first conviction,
yes,
even though the second one's thrown out.
And so we now go back to trial. John Flynn is his defense attorney. John Flynn was the person that argued before the Supreme Court. And the case was brought to the Supreme Court on the Sixth Amendment right to an attorney. But, of course, the Sixth Amendment spells it out that you have a right to an attorney at the time of judicial proceedings. That's pretty clear when you read the amendment itself. So the interesting part about this was he was defending him, Miranda, and we had been able to locate the person that lived with him. Her name was Twyla, and so we talked to her first, and Bob Corbin, he was the attorney general. Later, he was
county prosecutor then, right?
Yes, he was the county attorney at that time.
And attorney later, general of Arizona.
Right. And so when we were able to find her, and apparently she's on the witness list, but the defense didn't find her either, and I told them how to find her. It was a very simple thing. I said, I bet you the grandparents of Miranda's child knows where Twyla is today.
All right, now hold on a second. We're going to get to Twyla here. We're going to get to the hunt for Twyla when we come back. This Miranda case just keeps unraveling and unraveling and unraveling right before our eyes on the 50th anniversary of the Miranda case. It's coming up next on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back discussing the Miranda case, and Detective Cooley is on the hunt. Miranda has been convicted. His conviction is overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. It is sent back down for a retrial, and you're hunting for further evidence because you can't use the conviction. Now, you're looking for his, what appears to be a common-law wife.
Well,
that's
an interesting point.
The mother of his children.
Yes, that's a better way of putting
it. Okay.
So she agrees to testify, and I handle the interview at the request of Bob Corbin because for some reason he wanted me to. I don't know why, but I did. Made sure that she wasn't trying to get even with him for stepping out on her or whatever you want to say. She said she had made a new life for herself, and that was he wasn't in it. So I asked, would you testify? And first off, I asked her, did he ever admit to this this crime to you? And she said, yes, he did. And she told how he admitted and apologized.
And by the way, is that the point about wife? If she was a wife, she couldn't testify to that?
Well,
that
I'm correct? Getting, yes, correct? I'm getting to that. As soon as we call her as a witness, John Flynn jumps up. He objects. And the objection is client...
spousal. Confidentiality, yeah.
Yeah. She cannot testify. Because,
against her husband.
And he says it's privileged communications. And I tell Corbin, and I'm sure he must have known this, but he may not have known they weren't married. I don't know. And maybe Flynn didn't either. And I said to Corbin, they're not married. And so Corbin says to the judge, they're not married, nor have they ever been married. So the objections overruled. So then he says it's a common law marriage. Now, this is the part as a police officer that really confuses me. These guys are very trained attorneys. They've been to law school, and they don't know that Arizona is not a common law state. So, of course, I tell Corbin, there's no common law marriage in this state. So he also tells that to the judge, and the judge overrules the objection.
So he's more or less then convicted on
her testimony, on a confession, which was thrown out by the Supreme Court by the police. But she wasn't the police.
I want to get to Bob in just a second on what this all means. But there is one, I think, interesting personal aspect of this. He serves his time, which is like 10 years or something?
11 years.
He's out after 11 years, and how does he meet his end and where?
When he gets out, 9 months later, he's involved in a card game with two other Hispanic males in the downtown area of Phoenix, what we call Skid Row and Deuce at the time, we called it, at the La Amapola Bar. there is an argument that breaks out between the three of them. There's three guys. One of them is Fernando Rodriguez. He was known by the bartender. The other one was not known. The fight ensues, and Ernie beats them both up. Then he goes to the bathroom to wash off some blood, and Fernando goes over to a passed-out drunk on the floor, and he happened to know this guy had a knife, and he gets it out of his pocket, and he hands it to the other guy. Nobody seems to know who he is. And he says, here, finish it with this. Now, Fernando's smart enough. He's now leaving. And so he leaves with his girlfriend. Ernie comes out of the bathroom. The bartender, Marianne Estrella, she says, Ernie, and everybody called him Ernie, even though now that he's famous, he likes to be called Ernesto. This guy has a knife. So Ernie, who had just beaten him up, goes over and going to take a knife away. That was a mistake. The guy stabbed him twice, once in the stomach and once through the heart. Ernie dies on that dirty floor.
And I think the interesting thing to those in Phoenix is if you go watch a Suns basketball game, that's the approximate location.
Yes. Hmm. One other thing on that, if you want to continue.
Sure.
Fernando we pick up right away because he's known in the Deuce by the walking beat. But they don't know who the other guy is, and Fernando says he doesn't know either. We find out by description only that a suspect may be at the Salt River Hotel. The walking beat brings him in. He's read his rights, taken a picture. He says he doesn't speak English. We have an interpreter. And he says he wasn't there, knows nothing about it. He says, I don't even go to the bars. Then we release him. The next day, his fingerprints reveal that his name is Ezequiel Moreno Perez. And we go back to Salt River Hotel, and he's not there. And he's still out there in the wind somewhere, even though a warrant was issued. Mm-hmm. But he fled the country. And so that is kind of the end of the story.
Okay. Now, what about not the end of the story legally, Bob? What's the significance of this for law and legal practice?
Well, that's, of course, the end of Ernesto's story.
Yes, the end of Ernesto, yes. But not the end of Miranda as a verb.
No, not the end of Miranda as a verb. It lives on as a verb. Well, look, it was very interesting about Miranda, his actual case and what it shows. He was, of course, convicted on other evidence. So even though his confession was suppressed, he ends up getting convicted anyway, which tends to be the reality. Many times, or most of the time, when evidence is suppressed, the police or the prosecutors have other evidence and they go forward. And statistically, it showed that Miranda really hasn't had the huge effect that everybody said that it would have. Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully, it has had the effect of changing police practice and giving the people at least a chance.
And after all, maybe the point being, why does if somebody is going to confess, it's usually perhaps because they've got the goods on them anyway and they know it?
Oh, and absolutely. Yeah. And also, there's still a lot of room that police have. I mean, police can lie to people. They can say, hey, you know, I actually have the evidence on you and your guy over here already told us that.
And, that's OK.
Well, of course, that's OK. It's constitutionally just fine. Remember the movie L.A. Confidential when he runs back and forth and plays that? Supreme Court said, no problem. That's fine. As long as you're telling me he has a right to a lawyer. The police often use Miranda as a tool of interrogation. So they say, hey, you know, I really want to hear your story. I can't hear your story right now. I really want to hear your side. I need to hear your side because, you know, all these people are saying stuff about you and then, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, I just got to tell you these few things. And they kind of minimize it, but they slip Miranda in there. Okay, now I can finally hear your story. So what happened? Okay.
Nice.
It's done. and it's really amazing as a practicing criminal defense attorney how many cases are made with confessions, and they still are. Remember when we all used to watch that show Columbo? And he'd figure out clever things to find people guilty, or CSI. They do. Oh, we got to do the analysis of the hair sample, and it proves the guy. No, most police cases are solved by confessions. They get people to confess, and it's remarkable that they do that.
Well, I'll tell you what they told us in the Baltimore Police Academy in the early 1970s. They said, "You tell me you have the right to remain silent, et cetera, et cetera," and they said. And if they talk to you after that, they have a pretty good basis for an insanity defense.
Nice. Well,
there you go. Yeah, so at any rate, most cases are done with a confession. Here's what I think is the more interesting issue about Miranda, and that is, does it work? Has it worked? Has it done what it was supposed to do? From my point of view and other people, it really hasn't. Now, maybe you need to do something else in addition.
Because?
Well, I'll give you one statistic. 1 in 4 people who have been exonerated from DNA evidence after they've already been convicted confessed to the crime.
Wow.
1 in 4.
Wow.
If you look at, for instance, Gary Stewart, who's written a couple books, Innocent Until Interrogated, about the Tucson, the Temple murder case, and they got those 6 kids from Tucson to admit to crimes they had no connection with. Also, the Deborah Milkey case, which he's also written a book.
Get you scratching your head. Why would they confess?
There are so many coercive things that get done and coercive tactics. Now, this is where you get into kind of a semantic issue. Mm-hmm. Most confessions are coerced in some way, and they also tend to be honest. In other words, the police get people to admit the things they did. And that's the police job, and that's good that they do that job. The trouble is when those tactics spill over and get people to admit to things that they didn't do because they feel trapped or have no other option. Miranda was supposed to protect against that, and I'm afraid it really hasn't.
Hmm. Interesting. Wow. Holy cow, do we bring it on the think tank. Good job, Doc. Right. Look at you. I'm making it happen. All right, Carol Cooley, the arresting officer in the Miranda case, thank you so much for sharing the story. We appreciate getting that insight in Robert McWhirter. He is an attorney and legal scholar. Your book?
Bills, Quills, and Stills, an Annotated, Illustrated, and Illuminated History of the Bill of Rights.
Check that noise out. You can get that at Amazon, right?
You can get it at Amazon.
Okay, there we go. And if keep rewinding the podcast for the full title. Keep going. Thank you both so much for being here. We appreciate it. On behalf of Doc O'Neill, the entire KTR team, and myself, Mike Russell, thanks for spending some time with us right here on the Think Tank.